Welcome to New World Notes. This week, we'll reflect on the Aurora murders, and we'll take a somewhat different look at violence, at guns, and about how the establishment loves to crack down on retail mayhem while perpetuating and celebrating wholesale mayhem. I hope you'll stay tuned. Soon, we'll get to this issue. Wasn't the shooter in Aurora just acting presidential? But first, let's take a look at good guns versus bad guns. We've just had a couple of instances of mass shootings in a movie theater in Aurora and at a Sikh church outside Milwaukee. The Aurora shooting got the bigger press coverage. It had all the ingredients of a media powerhouse. It was connected with a big Hollywood movie release. The shooting involved some exotic weaponry. Most importantly, the victims were nice middle-class American white people. It pains me to say it, but the race and class of the victims seems to matter a whole lot around here. Well-publicized murders always lead some liberals to renew their call to ban civilian gun ownership. They've always been particularly eager to ban handguns. I'll say right off that I remain unpersuaded that banning anything is a good idea. But let's get back to Aurora. If nothing else, this crime shows the folly of classifying some guns as inherently evil, while others are okay. There are many very odd things about the Aurora shootings. Here's what strikes me as the oddest. According to official reports, the alleged shooter, James Holmes, brought three firearms into the theater. According to the New York Times, these were a .40 caliber Glock pistol, a Smith & Wesson Model MP15 rifle, apparently in caliber .223, and a 12-gauge Remington Model 870 shotgun. The rifle was fitted with an unusually big 100-round magazine. That's the part that holds the ammunition. Now, Holmes might have managed to conceal the handgun in his clothing. But a .223 rifle is a big, hefty, long piece of equipment, made even bigger and heftier in this case by the big, non-standard 100-round magazine. The Remington 870 shotgun, which Holmes also used, is another big, heavy, long gun. The standard Model 870 weighs 7.5 pounds unloaded and is 4 feet long from stem to stern. Now, handguns are less powerful than rifles and shotguns. The excuse for banning handguns is that they're easily concealable. I'm not sure why that makes them extra bad, but that's the argument. Now, will somebody please tell me how the Aurora shooter managed to bring a big rifle and a big 4-foot-long shotgun into a movie theater, unnoticed and unchallenged? How did he give his ticket to the usher? Here's how I picture it. He's holding the shotgun in his left hand, he's holding the rifle in his right hand, and he's got the paper ticket between his lips. At the entrance to the auditorium, the usher takes the ticket from his lips, rips it in half, puts the dry half into his box, and places the moist half of the ticket back between Holmes's lips. "Enjoy the show," he says. My son just broke in to tell me that I've got it all wrong. He says the culprit entered the auditorium without the guns. He then exited through a fire escape, wedging the door open. He retrieved the rifle, shotgun, and pistol, and re-entered through the fire door. Since my son is a teenager, I responded accordingly. Adopting an attitude of nonchalance, I shrugged my shoulders and replied, "Whatever." I'm an old English major, so I can't resist making a note on language. People who work on persuading the public that certain guns should be banned like to use words whose meaning is not widely known. Words that sound scary to the uninformed. A favorite is semi-automatic. To the uninformed, semi-automatic sounds extra deadly, sort of like a machine gun. It's not. It's just a technical description of how, after firing, the next round is moved from the magazine into the firing chamber and the hammer cocked. but saying the murder weapon was a semi-automatic Glock pistol sounds worse than the murder weapon was a Glock pistol, right? So that's what they say. When people start slinging around the term semi-automatic, they're probably trying to scare you more than inform you. It's like with cars. Suppose that when cars were used in a crime, you heard over and over that the crime car was fuel-injected. The abductor sped off with his screaming victim in a fuel-injected Toyota. The drunken driver smashed his fuel-injected pickup truck into the bridge abutment. Fuel-injected SUVs are the vehicle of choice for Mexican drug cartels. If you know nothing about car design except what you hear in the news, you start thinking that fuel-injected is some kind of dangerous new technology that particularly lends itself to automobile mayhem. Next thing you know, you're nodding in agreement when people say, "Police cars, of course, but why does a law-abiding civilian need a car that's fuel-injected?" Now, if you know a bit about auto mechanics, you see that the whole line of reasoning is preposterous. There's nothing scary or dangerous about a fuel injector. It's just a complicated type of carburetor. Same thing for semi-automatic firearms. Semi-automatic is just one of a half dozen simple mechanisms in common use by which a gun might operate. It has nothing to do with how lethal the gun is. Semi-automatic firearms have been in use in the hands of normal citizens since at least the 1890s. It's nothing special. It is technology from the age of steam locomotives. But getting back to Aurora. In fact, the handgun used in the shootings was of a semi-automatic design, and the rifle was too. But the shotgun was of an older design, called a pump action. The Remington 870 has been in continuous production since 1950. Now let's step back a bit. People who want to ban guns have decided they need to do it piecemeal, as the public would never consent to banning everything at once. This is a very clever strategy on their part. So they set about demonizing guns one category at a time. In the 1960s, their target was the so-called Saturday Night Special, low-powered, inexpensive handguns. They've since done their best to demonize all handguns. They had some recent, if temporary, success with so-called assault weapons. This is a category of guns that in fact doesn't even exist. It's a chimera. It's a grab bag collection of firearms that have nothing in common, except that, in different ways, they look kind of menacing. The difference between a so-called assault weapon and Uncle Jake's old deer rifle are cosmetic, arbitrary, and practically inconsequential. This is a long story, but the gist is, give something a scary name, and you can frighten all sorts of people who know very little about the subject. And currently high on the list of guns to be banned piecemeal are, quote, semi-automatic weapons, unquote. But the Aurora murders show that there are not good guns and bad guns. The Aurora shooter killed and injured people with a semi-automatic handgun, and he killed and injured people with a semi-automatic rifle, a rifle that some people would call an assault weapon. And he killed and injured people with a traditional, classic, old-fashioned pump-action shotgun, a gun designed especially for hunting and for shooting sports like trap shooting, the very sort of gun that the gun banners say they are not trying to ban. They just want to ban evil, bad guns. But there are not some good guns versus some bad guns. Good hunting rifles versus bad semi-automatic assault weapons. A gun is a gun. If you have one, you can possibly do good with it, or you can do harmless things with it, or you can do evil things, like kill unarmed strangers in a movie theater, like kill unarmed men, women, and children in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, like kill unarmed men after you've arrested them, frisked them, and put them in handcuffs. Or, in a recent case of this, in Jonesboro, Arkansas, after you've arrested him for marijuana possession, after you've frisked him twice, put him in handcuffs, hands behind his back, and put him in the rear cage of your police cruiser. Let's give the deceased his name. It's Chavis Carter. Seeing Carter handcuffed and dead in the back cage of their police cruiser, the arresting officers slowly realized that they'd have a hard time making the usual police claim that they shot the man in self-defense. And uh-oh, here come some witnesses. Too late to drag the corpse out of the police car and take off the handcuffs. So the police did the only thing they could. They announced that it was a suicide. Shot himself in the head. Okay, case closed. This year, there's also been a rash of police shooting and killing unarmed people in Anaheim, California. This year alone in that small city, police have shot no fewer than 6 people, killing 5. How come all the people who want to take guns out of the hands of average citizens never, ever suggest taking guns out of the hands of our government-controlled boys in blue? That should save a few hundred lives every year. Well, we have a couple of interesting articles to read on retail and wholesale violence in America. But first, let's have a little topical music. Here's an interesting song by Fred Eaglesmith called Time to Get a Gun. It's an anti-gun song. The character says he wants to buy a gun, but the character is a bit of a lowlife. But it's a fun song in a lot of ways, and what the heck, the singer is Canadian anyway. We'll follow that with a nice piece by Amy Davidson in The New Yorker. But first, here's Fred Eaglesmith.
Time to get a gun.
That was Fred Eaglesmith. On New World Notes, we're looking at good guns versus bad guns, good violence versus bad violence, good murders versus bad murders. I'm being ironic, of course, but I think it makes no sense to condemn shooting innocent people in a movie theater while you're praising exploding and incinerating innocent people in wedding parties overseas. Here's another item. According to the government's account, highly trained Navy commandos burst in and shot to death Osama bin Laden and his poor wife and other members of the household without making any attempt to arrest the man. The leaders of Nazi Germany were not summarily executed, but they were arrested and put on public trial. Years later, Adolf Eichmann got a public trial. Saddam Hussein was arrested and given a public trial. Osama bin Laden was not even charged with a crime related to 9/11. Can you believe that? No attempt was made to arrest him, and no trial was even contemplated. He and his whole household were merely shot to death on President Obama's orders. And how did Americans react to this bloody murder? They cheered. They celebrated. They toasted our heroes in uniform. They danced in the streets. The president's approval rating shot upwards. Obama did the same to Anwar al-Awlaki and members of his family. No charges were ever made. No specific accusations were even made. They killed Awlaki with a missile, and they killed his young son with another missile in a separate attack. No charges, no evidence of wrongdoing, no trial. And Awlaki and his child were American citizens. At the news of this officially sanctioned murder, Americans were not dancing in the streets. But they weren't calling for impeachment either. So James Holmes, the man arrested for the Aurora murders, might claim he was just acting presidential. Indeed, President Obama is now claiming that the Constitution grants him the right to kill any American he chooses, whenever he chooses. Excuse me, Congress impeached Bill Clinton for lying about a sexual affair. Then they let George W. Bush get away with bloody murder. Now they're letting Barack Obama get away with bloody murder, and they're letting him get away with announcing that bloody murder is perfectly legal. Just don't fondle the White House interns, and I'm okay, you're okay. When we celebrate and condone and cheer on rampant, needless violence committed by our leaders, why should we be surprised when those at the bottom of the heap start aping their betters? That's why the establishment and the media are so down on James Holmes. Instead of just obeying his superiors, he started imitating them. He got uppity. Here's a nice piece on a related theme. It's by Amy Davidson in The New Yorker, published May 30th. The title is The President's Kill List. I've slightly condensed it for radio. The President's Kill List. What is wrong with the president sitting in a room looking at lists and portraits of people? A Somali man, a 17-year-old girl, an American citizen, and deciding whom to kill. According to articles in both The Times and Newsweek, that is a job Barack Obama has assigned himself. His aides call this a matter of taking responsibility. If we are going to assassinate someone, or call in a drone strike to destroy a camp in Yemen, the president should make the call. As if our only alternative were some sort of rogue operation, with CIA agents shooting at will. But responsibility involves accountability, and that is badly lacking here. The kill list story is a reminder of how much language matters, and how dangerous it is when the plain meaning of a word is ignored. Here is some of the language they use. Baseball cards for the PowerPoint slides with the biographies and faces of targets. Terror Tuesday is meetings where targets are sorted out. Nominations for death-marked finalists. Personality strikes that aim to kill a person. And signature strikes that go after a group of people whose names we don't know, because of the way the people seemed, from pictures in the sky, to be acting. One senior official said, "The joke was that when the CIA sees three guys doing jumping jacks, the agency thinks it is a terrorist training camp." Signature strikes were also known as TADS, for Terrorist Attack Disruption Strikes, or just as crowd kills. Both articles explore Obama's halting efforts to confine signature strikes to Pakistan, rather than Yemen or Somalia, and how he ultimately didn't, really. One incident led to persuasive reports of dozens of women and children dying. More disturbing than childish names for brutal things are the absurd meanings given to more sober terms. The key ones are civilians and combatants, and due process. How do you minimize civilian casualties in a conflict? Just change the definition of civilian. According to the Times, Obama just counts all military-age males in a strike zone as combatants, unless there is explicit intelligence later proving them innocent. In other words, if we thought you were someone we should kill, and we did kill you, and you looked to be the right age, then you were guilty. If we bomb a house, and the bodies of a father, mother, teenage boy, and middle school-aged girl are found entangled with each other, then two are combatants and two are civilians. These words are important because of the argument that we have to act to protect ourselves. There is a terrorist on the screen. Hit him now! But how are we deciding who a terrorist is? In some cases, we don't even know the names of the people we're killing, in countries where we are not actually at war. In other cases, we do know their names and don't care who dies with them. In one strike, the identity of the man was known, and Obama made a deliberate decision to kill his wife and in-laws with him. The methods we have built over centuries for sorting out questions of guilt and innocence and probable cause is due process. And that may be the most degraded phrase of all. The Obama administration has deliberately killed American citizens, notably Anwar al-Awlaki. The Justice Department says this was legal, as the Fifth Amendment's guarantee of due process could be satisfied by internal deliberations in the executive branch. In other words, it's due process if the president thinks about it. And if an American, whom the president decides is a threat, can be assassinated in Yemen, where Awlaki was hit, why not Los Angeles? National security officials said that, in making all these decisions to kill, Obama has enormous faith in himself. It would be more responsible, though, if he had less. If he thought that he was no better than any other president we've had or ever will. The machine he has built is not only for him, but for his successors to use. In the end, we are being asked to trust not only Obama, but the office of the presidency. Do we? So ends Amy Davidson's nice piece, The President's Kill List. And let's end with a piece by Robert Kohler, here much condensed. It's from the Common Dreams website, July 26. It's titled, Good Violence, Bad Violence. Just as we all know there will be a next war, we know there will be more murder victims. We know because we live in a culture that tolerates and perpetuates violence. James Holmes may have been a loner, but like his predecessors, he acted in a complex American context. He wasn't alone at all. The U.S. is far more violent than other developed countries, for reasons seldom addressed or even looked at in anything like a holistic way. The root of the matter is our false distinction between good violence and bad violence. We don't address the issue systematically because of our social investment in good violence and the enormous payoff it delivers to some. The factors that make up our culture of violence include the following. 1. The media, entertainment, and news feed the popularity of, quote, good violence, unquote. Violence is the driving plot for thousands of special effects permeated flicks. movie and TV violence is abstract and consequence-free. The quickest way to solve a problem, find love, attain manhood, do good. America's Army, the violent video game maintained by the U.S. Army, sucks in 13-year-olds. Why are we violent but not illiterate? Asked Coleman McCarthy. The answer, we're taught to read. Violence sells. Violence advertises. Give us a war, any war, and the media will line up behind it. 2. Violence drives government policy. We are now engaged in an endless Orwellian war against dark-skinned foreign evil. The Washington Consensus is the same thing as the military-industrial complex. We torture. We carpet bomb. We've wrecked 2 countries, killed civilians by the hundreds of thousands. We assassinate by drone. We keep our official civilian count low by regarding all dead military-age males as combatants. By this measure, 7 of Holmes's victims in Aurora don't count. We're continuing to develop the next generation of nuclear weapons. Violence also drives domestic policy. Our prison industrial complex is the largest in the world. We have no mercy on the poor. Social spending bears the brunt of austerity. The police are becoming increasingly militarized. We control through punishment. And 3, we worship winning and create unity around common enemies. Racism is endemic. We live in a domination culture. Competition rules. The default American truism is survival of the fittest. Everything we do is based on the military model. We go to war against all our problems rather than try to heal them. So ends Good Violence, Bad Violence by Robert Kohler. And that's the theme of our show today. For New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Watch out for cars with semi-automatic transmissions. And if you can practice non-violence today, that would be cool too. Ciao.